collectible music since 1987. Into the Music is located in the Exchange District, 245 McDermott at the corner of King Street. To receive our twice-weekly newsletter, call the store or go online at intothemusic.ca to sign up. And kick off your Friday.
Since the late 1970s. Why do modern movements for women's rights around the world completely ignore the role and plight of women in Palestine under the brutal weapon of Israeli occupation and war? This week on the Global Research News Hour, as we go on air on the eve of International Women's Day, we review the state of the women's movement today and reveal its many shortcomings and uses, in fact, to enable the male-dominated fields of imperialism and war against Mother Nature. In our first half hour, Professor Claudia von Werlhoff joins us to talk about the principle of fighting patriarchy, which is missing in the modern women's movement, and about how we must tackle it before our silence rips apart the earth itself. Then in our second half hour, we are joined once again by author, broadcaster, and journalist Sonali Kolhatkar to share some of the history of the dismantling of establishment of women's rights in Afghanistan as being linked to U.S. imperialistic control. Finally, we talk to Noor Jagama, a Palestinian-American and Code Pink organizer, about how the feminist movement in the United States is being exploited as an enabler of imperialistic control at the expense of the rights of women in Palestine, Iran, and elsewhere. On this week's program, Modern Feminists Leading the Charge for Patriarchy, a review of the women's movements today. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 7th, 2025. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for stream or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. We acknowledge the responsibility of settlers and newcomers to this territory to accept the resources and the abundance of the land in a fair and equitable way with the indigenous people who were here first, to honor the treaties and promises made in the past, and for accountability for the harms in the form of colonialism and genocide that followed, and that we may align respectful partnerships between both peoples in the present and the future. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. As always, money talks and big business is really pulling the strings. Zelensky did not, in the event, sign the minerals deal with Trump and is now desperate to do so to try to get American cash flowing his way again. It is worth noting that Starmer's delusional, quote, 100-year alliance, unquote, agreement with Zelensky contained the UK's attempt to grab the same minerals Zelensky is now asking again to be allowed to hand over to Trump. You find this in the UK-Ukraine 100-year partnership at, quote, Pillar 5, Para 3, Article 4, unquote, 4, supporting development of a Ukrainian critical minerals strategy and necessary regulatory structures required to support the maximization of benefits from Ukraine's natural resources through the possible establishment of a joint working group. While we are on the subject, most people sensibly ignored the detail of this crazy, quote, 100-year, unquote, agreement on the entirely sensible grounds that none of it is ever going to happen. That comes from the article Ukraine, Diplomacy and War, Craig Murray, by Craig Murray, posted March 6th, originally published on Craig Murray's website. And then there are the reactions of utter shock from all corners who call this fight an historic and a diplomatic turning point to be immortalized. It is hard, I know, to hear an unbearable possibility, but suppose it were a performance, not just in the sense that Trump and Vance set Zelensky up, but as a coordinated reality TV show in which all the principal actors were performing from a script whose goal was the opposite of all the subsequent interpretations. A script that allowed for some improvisation, as comedians like Zelensky and reality TV stars like Trump are adept at. Improvisations that may have gone a step too far and elicited outbursts that tarnished the performance but did not derail the overall goal of showing that the puppet apprentice serves at the whim of the show's host, and despite all the loot showered upon him, he could still be fired and replaced with another puppet as the play would proceed under a new name. That comes from the article, Whose Dog Was Being Wagged During Showtime Between Trump and Zelensky, Edward Curtin. By Edward Curtin, posted March 6th, originally published on the author's website, Behind the Curtin. Consider some of Trump's other uses of alternative facts, misdirection, and misnomers to advance the deep state's agenda. In true doublespeak fashion, Trump's path to peace leads to more war. At the same time that he's threatening to halt military aid to Ukraine in the name of securing peace with Russia, Trump's administration is sending $4 billion in weapons and ammunition to Israel so it can continue to wage war on Gaza. Trump's path to nationalism by way of isolationism is in fact empire building. At the same time that Trump is declaring himself a nationalist, breaking ranks with America's allies, withdrawing from international accords, and ceding ground to authoritarian regimes such as Russia, he's also declaring his intent to lay claim to foreign lands such as Gaza, Greenland, and Canada as part of a global power grab. That comes from the article, The Deep State's War on Truth, Waged with Doublespeak, Delusion, and Propaganda, by John W. Whitehead and Nisha Whitehead, posted March 6th, originally published on the Rutherford Institute. The Kremlin has already bogged down in the much weaker Ukraine, and if a confrontation between Europe and Russia were to occur, we would be in a nuclear scenario, an endgame that no one wants. In other words, the current military tensions are not so much the result of geopolitical conflicts with Russia, China, and now even the U.S., but rather rooted in the Western monopoly capital's drive for maximum profit and expansion. To secure the profits of Western monopolies, investments and markets abroad, as well as the supply of cheap raw materials from those countries, must be guaranteed. And for that, a strong military apparatus is indispensable to bring defiant countries to order if necessary. That comes from the article, The Terrifying Militarization of Europe, by Mark Van de Piet, posted March 6th.
These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
Rosalie Bertel was a Catholic nun and scholar specializing in biometry,
environmental disaster, and health questions, she seemed skeptical of the accomplishments of or even the direction of today's women's movements, alluding to the fact that they did not recognize the new developments of technology, the military, and weapons against Mother Earth, insisting that women have the same right to join the military as men, or the same right to be a participant in HAARP or developing nuclear weapons, is to miss the boat altogether, and to display the movement itself has to a certain extent disappeared or even been corrupted by a force known as patriarchy. With this year's golden anniversary of the UN commemoration of International Women's Day arriving, we're going to examine this larger understanding of women's vital role in fighting patriarchy and not just achieving gender equality with the apparent heir of Rosalie Bertel's work. Claudia von Wirlhoff, born in 1943 near Berlin, Germany, is a university professor of political sciences and women's studies in Austria at Innsbruck, developed the critical theory of patriarchy, co-founded FIPAS, the Research Institute for the Critique of Patriarchy and Alternative Civilizations, the Planetary Movement for Mother Earth, and Boomerang, Journal for the Critique of Patriarchy. And she's also a research associate of the Center for Research on Globalization in Montreal. Could you talk about patriarchy? I mean, what do you mean by that term, and when and why did it come into existence in the first place?
Well, it's a difficult story, but I did my best to dismantle it in a way, because normally, if at all, the term patriarchy is used, it is used as a term that defines something like a rule of men over women, or the domination of men, and something like a political category of rule over, but mostly nothing else. And what we learned also with Rosalie Bertel was that patriarchy has a totally different meaning, a much more general meaning that includes especially technologies. That is something normally not seen and not conceived as a problem, but we did our best to define it that way. One could say that patriarchy is a system, and our civilization is patriarchal today as well, is a system that tries to change the natural order as such, especially the fact that Mother Earth, as well as women in general, are those who create life and who are the creators of life in general worldwide. And this is exactly what a patriarchal ruler or a patriarchal idea does not like. They want to be the rulers themselves, and they want to be the creators themselves. So something like we could say that the planet is organized in a motherly way. The planet is our mother, Mother Earth. And the fathers are just a term that is different. And the fathers in patriarchy, pater means father, that's a Latin term, want to be the origin, arche. This is a Greek term, patriarchy, pater and arche. They want to be the creators of everything. And this means that they have developed a system in which all natural conditions and women as creators are destroyed and replaced by something else. At least this is their utopia. The utopia of patriarchy is replacing the world as it is by something else, namely a fatherly world or an artificially produced world that is not natural anymore and is beyond women and nature, so to say. This is the big movement that patriarchy that exists since about 6,000 years only, this is not much, has followed. It's the path of patriarchy that we can see today. And Rosalie was the first to acknowledge this in relation to our planet as such. So the military tries to change the Earth as a living being, as our Mother Earth, and transform her into a weapon of war. This is what she found out in her book, in her last book, Planet Earth, the Latest Weapon of War, in 2000. So this is the larger line that we have explained by our research, and that means that all these idea of rule of men by over women only is just one feature or one part of the whole game, and that the whole game is essential for men as well and for everybody else and for nature as such, because it is destructive. It's first of all destructive. I call this method the alchemical standard procedure. It is a method that starts with destroying everything and then using the matter that is left to rebuild it with something else together. So in order to create some artificial world, and this world today is the machine world. So this, in short, is our definition of patriarchy, which is much broader and much more important than all these other definitions we had until now.
Rosalie Bertel's work and your writing on patriarchy reminds me of the book Frankenstein, written by Mary Shelley, who is a woman, by the way. In fact, she wrote as a teenager 2,200 years ago. This man, Victor Frankenstein, who insisted on creating life when only women can do that, but was using modern technologies to artificially replace the work of nature, Mother Earth, with a superior equivalent, I guess. And I think we have people like Frankenstein all over the place today. This story was the first major warning of patriarchy, I think, and its effects on humanity and the world. What are prominent examples of patriarchy's malefacts in the 21st century today?
Well, the whole technological development. I mean, the machine technology was the first attempt to replace a living nature that was defined as dead matter by the sciences, to replace her by a machine production or a machine world, which is important because the machine is not just a device or so, but is a system which is growing all the time, because the machine tries to transform everything into machinery, not just what it did already, but all the rest. This is what Günther Anders, one of the most important critics of machine production, and he is a philosopher in Austria, he said it's the trend towards the one machine. Everything is becoming only a single machine, or what Mumford called the mega machine. And this is exactly what is happening today with the new fourth industrial revolution. That is, all these technologies in the micro and macro level, starting with the Earth, like Bertel, down to DNA, to synthetic biology, nanotechnology, artificial intelligence, and all the biological technologies that are related to this concept of destruction, down to subatomic levels even, and all the atomic industry, of course, is part of the same game, and transform that into a new, totally new creation that has nothing to do with nature and its development and evolution anymore. So this is until we have the problem with transhumanism, that this technology also includes the human as such, men and women and everything, trying even to replace the mother by a machinery.
Yeah.
So you have that is a very, it's just what is happening today is exactly the last phase or the last possibility this technology of patriarchy has developed.
The counterforce, as I understand it, against patriarchy then is a female-dominated matriarchy. What's an example of recognizing this principle and applying it in a practical way?
Well, no matriarchy was never a female-dominated civilization. I mean, a matriarchal civilization is much older than the patriarchal one, and did never develop a domination system or a system that was ruled by women instead of men. This is a lie that is repeated everywhere all the time. Matriarchal society, which is there have been so many researchers of matriarchal societies until now, that is a knowledge that is not recognized anywhere, it seems, because matriarchal society was in tune with nature. And this is exactly the difference to patriarchal society, that wants to destroy nature and replace her by something else. So this is the difference. By the way, very difficult to see that, because patriarchs don't tell their inventions as post-natural or anti-natural ones, but they say it's the new nature, it's the better nature, and it's the second nature, etc., the more developed nature, because they try to avoid that people see what's really happening. So the matriarchal stuff is something else, which is very different from patriarchy, especially in that it never developed a technology or anything against nature, but cooperated with nature all the time. Something like a culture oriented towards the nature that was surrounding it. So this is the complete difference to patriarchal and to patriarchal development.
As I understand it, like indigenous peoples all over the world, as I understand it, they, you know, worked according to that matriarchal principle, that, you know, of working with nature and not working for the, you know, the big buck or whatever. Is that essentially what we're talking about reverting to?
Yes, as far as they are still, they're still matriarchal or nearly or quasi matriarchal, because most of the indigenous peoples have been destroyed by colonizers, etc. So they have lost their matriarchal qualities as a society, but there are many left. Many are left, and there are still matriarchal groups and societies around the world, but they are now threatened by globalization and everything, and, you know, all that destruction that takes place. But they still exist, so you can prove that they really exist and have existed so far. And what I see in the alternative movements, social movements around the world, in the south of this planet, most of them really want to return to a matriarchal society, even if they don't call it like that. The term matriarchy is not really used, or patriarchy in that way. But from their content, it's very clear that they want to return to a nature-based and cooperative society without rules, domination, and all that stuff that we know from patriarchy, especially in modern times of related to capitalist patriarchy. So this is clear. They want to return. That they, I mean, it happened in Europe as well, when Europe became modern in modern times, and all these movements of the peasants and the women were related to a return to a matriarchal past, because Europe was a matriarchal society as well. But this is normally it's not recognized, but this is a fact. So we have that in common. But until now, it is very difficult to return from a patriarchal society to a matriarchal one. This has never happened until now, but people want to do it in a way. It would be a solution for many, many problems.
A lot of the problem. Go ahead.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Okay.
A lot of the problem is that it's not. These issues, they're not well explained by media, especially today.
No.
Yeah. How no. Could we alter the media, given its strong allegiances to the corporate and military sectors? Can we counter patriarchy in the media, or is media, like the military, so patriarchy-dominated that it should be abandoned altogether?
Yes, but the media wouldn't do that. I mean, we know what the media are and how they function. I mean, they are alternative media. And of course, I think that the situation is going to be worse, always more. I call it the alchemical war system in which we are in now. And you will have wars around the world always, and people will have to try to get to another civilization. Of course, they will try to. But until now, there is no understanding of the real problem. That is what I call patriarchy. It's not understood at all, and most people are really react aggressively because they think, "Oh, men are the are now be blamed, etc." But it's a question of much more than just men. It's a system. I call it also. It hates life. It's a hatred of life that we are experiencing because everything which is alive is going to be destroyed by these technologies and these interests behind, like the military and capital, etc. And this is what is occurring. But people until now do not understand what is really happening. So this is a question of how to make this known. People will know when they are treated like transhumans now, or when these technologies are experienced as bad and as destructive. Maybe then they will understand, because then they are affected personally even. And they will change their mind, but I don't know. I mean, I'm preparing the publication of my book, which is already in English translation, and it's called Fathers of the Void. And subtitle is On the Delusion, or on the mania to create a new world. So this is meant by patriarchy, who say that they are constructing a better and a higher and a more civilized world, but a world which is beyond nature, women, and all what we love. So the question of hatred is for me very important as the ultimate term that explains what is really happening. They don't like us. They want to do away with us. They hate us. I mean, as the living beings and the living planet we are. So this is the problem. And this, by the way, this gender question you mentioned in the beginning, the gender question has nothing to do with any women's movement. This is something from above that prepares women and men to lose their sex, what is called sex generally. Gender is a social term, the social term, and sex is the more biological term. They want to try to destroy us by losing our sex in the form that is the natural sex we have. So this is a part of this technological project of transforming the world into an anti-natural and a totally alien to nature civilization. But most people don't, all these trans discussion, etc., don't understand whom they are serving when they participate in this game.
Yeah, just in the 30 seconds we've got left, I mean, do you want to comment on, like, because you're a professor emerita of political science and women's studies, and yes, you taking a broad critique of modern feminism. I mean, have you gotten any negative feedback for your work on fighting patriarchy?
Well, the gender question is, this is not feminism. Feminism is what we had in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, this was further on destroyed more and more by neoliberalism and all these approaches that came from high above, like gender, etc. So this is not feminism. Feminism is something that is where I come from and that tries to define what is the problem. I mean, this is our critical theory of patriarchy is exactly one of the outcomes of real feminism, various the gender and other questions of the political participation of women in war and etc. And what you quoted in the beginning is something that we, of course, abhor. I mean, would never participate in that, of course.
Dr. Von Wohlhoff, it was a pleasure chatting with you again. Thank you so much for agreeing to be my guest, and happy International Women's Day to you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Dr. Claudia von Wohlhoff is Professor Emerita of Political Science and Women's Studies at the University of Innsbruck in Austria. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. When it comes to women's rights, sadly being at its very worst, Afghanistan is often at the front and center of conversation. Joining us to talk about the rise and fall of women's rights in the country historically and the hope of a rebound in the future, we're joined by Sonali Kolhatkar. She is an award-winning journalist, broadcaster, writer, and author. Sonali is also the founding co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission, a U.S.-based nonprofit solidarity organization that funds the work of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, which is an independent political social organization of Afghan women fighting for human rights and for justice in Afghanistan. Sonali, thanks again for agreeing to come on the Global Research News Hour radio program.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It is a little-known fact in the West who consume corporate media that in the 1960s and the 1970s that Afghanistan was not the quite the backward country informed by extremist religion that it is today. It was a secular country and women had made strides in terms of equal rights under the Constitution and the right to education and careers as teachers, doctors, scientists, and civil servants. Do you know anything about the story behind that rise of women's rights in those days?
And I wouldn't necessarily say secular fully. You know, Afghanistan has always been, like so many countries in the global south and elsewhere, a country of sort of two halves. You have urban centers, you have rural areas, and often rural areas, particularly when you talk about countries that have a lot of farmland, rural areas tend to be stuck in a certain time period. Urban areas where there's a lot of commercial activity tend to be more progressive, maybe more modern, certainly more industrial. And that was the case for Afghanistan in the 60s and the 70s. And it was secular, but not necessarily a democracy. There was a king who had a forward-thinking approach, Muhammad Zahir Shah, who in the 70s in particular took over and was trying to usher in a progressive era in Afghanistan. It was a country that had so much promise, similar to the promise in that era of other countries in the global south where women's rights were becoming recognized, you know, similar to the United States where women's rights were becoming recognized, of course, albeit at a different level, sort of relatively speaking. There are people who know that deep history a lot better than I do. Where my study of Afghanistan really kicks in is how the United States, because I'm an American, responded to effectively what turned into a Soviet takeover of that monarchy in Afghanistan. That monarchy was taking Afghanistan in a direction that was positive, but it was still a monarchy. And then you had the Soviets occupy, and then you had pretty much downhill or rather backward movement of Afghanistan and particularly Afghan women's rights. Afghan women's rights have for long been a marker of the nation's progress as a whole, just as it is in many other countries. The status of women's rights is often a harbinger of progress, you know, of any nationwide.
Yeah, you mentioned the U.S. involvement. What exactly was it that caused the loss of women's rights in the post-1979 era? I mean, was it through the influence of the fundamentalist Mujahideen who seized a kind of paramilitary power of their own, or is there more to it than that?
Those are the broad strokes of it. I mean, basically, here, you know, you see Afghan women's rights being used as a justification for intervention over and over again. This is the sad story of Afghanistan. So when the Soviets came in the late 70s, they took over the nation, claiming that they would save Afghanistan from rising fundamentalist forces in Afghanistan, that they were going to come and they were going to save Afghan women. You still see a lot of sort of old pro-Soviet forces claiming that, you know, Afghan, or showing photographs of Afghan women wearing very modern, you know, revealing 70s style clothing, which was true in the urban centers, not so true in the rural areas at all. But the Soviets claimed that that was a reason to, or that was one of many reasons to invade Afghanistan. They did so in the late 1970s. It started a 10-year-long occupation. So this is, of course, at the height of the Cold War, when the United States and the Soviet Union were engaged in a Cold War, and they had various proxy battlefields, and Afghanistan became the worst proxy battlefield. And so you saw the United States planning on turning Afghanistan into the Soviet Union's Vietnam. That was the sort of behind-the-scenes language used at the CIA. We're going to give the Soviet Union its Vietnam in Afghanistan, which was a way of saying we're going to bog it down so much in this country that we're going to cripple the USSR by feeding fundamentalist anti-Soviet forces, who were the Mujahideen fighters, billions, millions and billions in weaponry, training, cash. And that's what the United States did without any thought as to what the impact would be on the Afghan people of empowering these very fundamentalist, regressive, violent forces. And that was where you had the Mujahideen warlords who, through various political parties and various formations and private small to big militias, got, you know, were funneled so much money to fight the Soviets, to kill the Soviets. Yeah, this 10-year-long bloody occupation. And eventually the US did manage to get the Soviets to leave. They lost, the Soviets lost a huge number of soldiers. And when they left, the United States left Afghanistan in the hands, in the power of these Mujahideen groups, these fundamentalist warlords that they had empowered. And it didn't matter that these men, they were all men, these warlords, were going to basically turn their weaponry onto the people of Afghanistan, and particularly the women of Afghanistan. And that is a very, you know, that is was the worst tragedy in Afghanistan history that kicks off and unleashes and lays the groundwork for the Taliban, who are still there today.
Yeah. I mean, can you talk about any other ways that the decline of women in Afghanistan had American fingerprints on it, besides, you know, funding and arming and training the Mujahideen?
I mean, the United States, just like the Soviets, basically claimed to come in to save Afghan women. In 2001, the United States did just that. And so there's a little bit of history there that's missing, right? So Afghanistan was left in the hands in the early 80s and early 90s, throughout the 80s and early 90s, in the hands of these Mujahideen forces. And the Taliban came in from Pakistan. They were exiled Pashtun warriors in Pakistan, who, with the help of Pakistan, because Pakistan saw its opportunity to influence Afghanistan, invaded Afghanistan literally using the same rubric. We're going to save the Afghan people, and particularly the Afghan women, from the violence and war of the Mujahideen, because at that time, the Mujahideen had basically broken into an all-out civil war, fighting one another and killing and just, you know, destroying the capital, Kabul, and killing untold numbers of Afghan people, raping Afghan women. The Taliban came in the mid-90s to Afghanistan, claiming to save Afghan women, and then installed their own version of peace, quote-unquote, which was to basically not allow women to have any rights whatsoever. And when the September 11th attacks happened here in the United States in 2001, within a month, the United States invaded Afghanistan, not only in revenge for the September 11th attacks, but again, claiming to save Afghan women from the Taliban. And that kicked off the U.S.'s longest ever war that ended, you know, went from 2001 to 2021. And so we had a 20-year-long war that left Afghan women back where they started under the Taliban, which is where we are today. I mean, one occupation after another, one war after another, and the United States basically handing power back to the very same men that they were fighting, claiming that these were the men that they were going to now leave the country in the hands of, even though in 2001, they were wanting to save Afghan women from these same formations.
Well, there is a, I guess, a movement of women in Afghanistan that's fighting this if the imperialist powers are not, and that's the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan. I'm wondering if you could tell us one of your favorite stories about how Rawa is fighting for women's rights, even when times were at their worst.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because we get this impression, especially from the history I just told, that Afghans are this helpless people who don't, who've just been victimized over and over again, and nothing could be further from the truth. Inside Afghanistan, there have been untold numbers of university students, women, academics, activists, politicians as well, ordinary people fighting for their country, fighting for democracy, fighting for women's rights, fighting for secularism. And Rawa is one of the main formations. They are the oldest feminist organization in Afghanistan. And I came to them as an American solidarity activist in the year 2000 when I first discovered their work. And they have been fighting nonviolently for a democratic, secular Afghanistan for decades, and they continue to fight today. I went and visited them in 2005 when I did the groundwork and the research for my book, Bleeding Afghanistan, where I got to see them firsthand. Before that, several of their members had traveled to the United States, and after that, they have traveled to the United States for speaking tours that I've organized for them, and I've learned so much from them about the work that they do. Their main way of helping Afghan people, they play the long game. The long game is education. That doesn't sound very sexy, but it is. They believe, truly believe, that an educated population is the best way for Afghanistan to take back its own power, to take back its own country, to have a population that understands their rights. And they, from my perspective, one of the most interesting things about Rawa is that they emphasize education, women's education, girls' education, but it's very, very important to them that boys are educated as well. And I love this about Rawa's work. You can't have societies that privilege one gender over another ever, whether it's the Taliban oppressing women or whether it's women's organization leaving out boys' education. Any country will only survive into the next generation if both young, children of both sexes, if boys and girls, and of course, never want to leave out our minority populations who don't identify as either boys or girls, but our young people needing to be educated to understand that women's rights must be respected and human rights must be respected. Women's rights are human rights. So Rawa has always done that. They've had schools for boys and girls. They've also had just girls-only schools. They pick projects based on the context, based on the setting, based on who they're working with. There's no cookie-cutter approach. They are sovereign organization, and that's, I love the relationship between Afghan Women's Mission, which is their nonprofit solidarity arm that helps Rawa raise money, and Rawa. Our relationship is one that takes Rawa's lead. We never, ever tell Rawa what to do and how to do it, which is unfortunately the dynamic that's been set up by a lot of Western nonprofits, telling organizations in the Global South how to run their projects. Rawa takes the lead, lets us know what they need, and we fund it. And this is really, really important. So yes, educating boys, I think, is one of the most interesting aspects of Rawa's work.
Sonali, I really appreciate engaging you on this important issue. I thank you once again for speaking about it with our listeners.
Thank you so much, Michael. And, you know, it's 2025. It's been 4 years of the Taliban having taken over Afghanistan again, that the U.S. basically handed the country to them. And they are bringing back the late 90s and early 2000s. They're bringing back that dark era in Afghanistan. So I just urge your listeners, please don't forget Afghan women again.
Thank you. Sonali Kalhatkar is an award-winning journalist, broadcaster, writer, and author, and the founding co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission. She joins us from Pasadena. Does your feminism include Palestine? That is the name of an article published at Global Research back in October of last year, just before the presidential election. It mentions that while a women's march was alive and strong, there was no mention of the pivotal issue of the women of Afghanistan, of Palestine, who have endured the brutality of anti-feminist policies for decades under the illegal occupation by Israel. And certainly today, with women and children making up 70% of the deaths in the so-called war against Hamas, that according to the UN Human Rights Office, Noor Jaghama co-wrote the article. We thought we would bring her on to talk about the way Western feminism seems to be exploited and co-opted to serve imperialist aims. Noor is Code Pink's Palestine and Iran campaigner. Noor graduated from DePaul University with a bachelor's degree in international studies in June 2022. She has been advocating for Palestinian liberation for over 5 years, including organizing within her university. She also organizes around related issues such as abolition. Noor, thank you. It's good to have you joining us.
Thanks, Michael. Glad to be here.
Now, your article mentions how women are working in Palestine to navigate acts of care under extreme, unimaginable conditions. Could you please tell our listeners an example about the kinds of things your grandmother did during the Israeli occupation where she was located?
Yeah, so both my parents grew up in the West Bank in Palestine, and, you know, just a lot of different, you know, types of control on, you know, the day-to-day lives of Palestinians, one of those being curfews that are imposed on Palestinians. So basically what that means is when the sun goes down, not only are you not allowed to leave your house, you're not allowed to have lights on in your home, and you're not allowed to have any movement in your house. And if the Israeli occupation forces actually, you know, see you violating this curfew, they'll just plainly like shoot at people. And so where my mother grew up in Palestine, it was like kind of on a hill. So the Israeli occupation forces would often use the roof of their home as kind of like a watchtower when these curfews were imposed to make sure that people weren't leaving their homes. But one night, my uncle, one of my mom's brothers, you know, he was a baby at the time, and he was crying for milk, and they didn't have any at home, right? But it was curfew, so, you know, you can't really leave, go get it. But at the end of the day, my grandmother is a mother, right? And a mother is always going to want to protect their children and give their children what they need. So I think that she understood what she had to do, and what she thought that was to go out and, you know, go to the village a few houses down and get this milk for my uncle, which she did. She, you know, the way my mother tells me the story is that she thought that it was the last time that she would speak to my grandmother. And I do believe that that is how she felt because of how extreme these curfews were. So my grandmother, you know, goes out and, you know, she gets the milk, and she successfully makes it back. And it was kind of like a miracle, honestly. And when I wrote this article back in October, what I actually didn't know and what I found out later from my mom was that the occupation forces actually did shoot at my grandmother because they saw her out on this mission to just get milk for her baby, something so simple. But you know, she made it back and she kind of was tucked away in the shadows behind different, you know, homes, going through backyards. And then she made it back and got milk for her child, which I think for her was really a revolutionary act, because, you know, something so simple like feeding your child, just as a mother, something that you want to do. Yeah, it put her life at risk, which is just insane.
Yeah, she seems to have been like one of those unsung heroes, you know, doing her her work. And of course, you'd have sort of the same thing is happening today. I mean, but only emphasized both in Gaza and in the West Bank as well. And with all of that happening, I find the feminists, well, you find the feminists in the West are oblivious to the plight of women in Palestine. And I suppose you could also include members of the Democratic Women's Caucus, so Tuesday night, dressed up in pink, you know, sort of a silent protest against President Trump's policies against women during his presidential speech. But, you know, Noor, people by and large may not be aware of the impacts on women in Palestine, given the limited coverage. Could this not be more of a problem with media reporting than the problem with feminism itself?
Yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily feminism itself that's the issue. It's the co-optation of feminism, you know, to serve imperialist goals. And I think that, you know, it's media that uses feminism as a tool to do so. It's, you know, different entities like the US government, different political parties. It's not feminism that's the issue. It's the co-optation of it. So, you know, using feminism to justify imperialism, like you mentioned, you know, women kind of like, you know, wearing the aesthetics of feminism while not actually putting in practice the real work that it takes to actually live as a feminist, which is inherently an anti-imperialist thing. You know, you can't, if you, you know, the most extreme end of it is the war aspect of it, right? Like killing women is not feminist, right? But then if you think about different things like, you know, painting a group of women as like not being able to make decisions for themselves, or even more so painting the men, like say the men of Palestine, as like aggressive or barbaric, and, you know, painting them in this way not only makes Palestinian women, you know, kind of infantilizes them as if they can't, you know, make decisions for themselves or navigate within their own society, you know, with in the proper way, as if they don't understand the society that they live in. But also, when you criminalize a group of men, you know, does that not affect the women in a community as well? Like when the men of Palestine are, you know, painted as barbarians and then, you know, detained by the Israeli occupation forces for sometimes no reason at all, does it not then affect the women of the family and the women of the community that have to step up and maybe, you know, financially provide for their family, protect their children, or just, you know, do all of the duties of the household, you know, when before there was that support system? So, yeah, it's not feminism that is the issue, right? It's so many things that use feminism to serve imperialist goals and to impose violence on Palestinian men, women, and children.
Mm. You're also the Code Pink campaigner for Iran. We all know about how Iranian women were forced to wear the hijab and otherwise had their attire regulated, and their rights are restricted in other ways as well. Then after 22-year-old Mahsa Amini died in police custody following detention, presumably for not having proper women's attire, massive protests grew. Okay, so massive, I guess, feminist protests against the hijab, but on the other hand, minimal, if any, protests against the U.S. sanctions on Iran and the impacts they have. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. How do you account for this different response to two different human rights violations?
Yeah, I think this is kind of goes into just like looking at the aesthetics of feminism, right? And also allowing your feminism to be clouded by other things that, you know, other different types of oppression in the world, like Islamophobia, for example. I think that, you know, Western women are comfortable when their biases against Muslim women, for example, are confirmed, right? If you know, hijab is imposed on a group of women. That's obviously not right, you know, but a woman in the West, or, you know, just people in the West in general, might see that as, yes, hijab itself is inherently bad, when in reality, you know, that is not the issue at hand here. In the same way that their judgment is clouded due to these other biases they have, kind of stops them from seeing the bigger picture, like you mentioned, sanctions on Iran that actually, you know, stop Iranians from being able to progress in different ways in their society, just as it happens in Palestine. The way the occupation stops the progression of culture and education, it's the way our biases cloud our judgment from actually seeing the oppression for what it is. And instead, you know, in the West here, it just confirms, you know, these predisposed notions that we already have of these groups of people. I don't know if that answers your question, but yeah, that's like kind of the discrepancy I see there. Just like our judgment is clouded, right? And I think we owe it to the women of Iran and the women of Palestine and all over the world to operate with the clarity of getting straight to the root of this issue, which is imperialism, Western imperialism. And through tackling that issue, that is how we end up uplifting these women, rather than, you know, kind of getting caught up in the aesthetics of feminism and not allowing ourselves to actually, you know, support these women in their liberation movements the way that we should be, which is allowing them to have the agency to make these decisions and us being present to support them in the way that they are asking us to.
So, yeah, I mean, women's rights at home and women's rights abroad, they're connected. And I know International Women's Day is coming up in a few short days. I'm wondering, you know, what kind of a checklist do you have, say, for discerning whether or not the feminism that your practice is not being co-opted, that it is all embracing progressive philosophy as opposed to the exploited kind that enables patriarchy of violence and exploitation?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, checking your biases, like I mentioned, kind of, you know, checking in with yourself on what is actually at the root of like this issue. Why are we here? You know, like, for example, with the women's marches, what purpose were those marches actually there to serve, right? Was it actually to, you know, uplift women across the globe? No, because we know that Palestinian women were intentionally left out of that conversation, right? So if your feminism comes at the expense of another group of women, then, you know, it can't actually be feminism, can it? Because, you know, you're ignoring this entire group of women. And I think that approaching feminism from an anti-war and an anti-imperialist perspective, and I would argue even an anti-Zionist perspective, which I think falls under imperialism, that is a really good way to check your biases and to make sure that, you know, your feminism, I'm not saying that people should or can be perfect, right? But, you know, just going on that path of like kind of the best practice of approaching, you know, an issue and making sure that you're truly coming from a feminist perspective. Because feminism is something that is growing and evolving as well, you know, as we grow and evolve and find new ways to uplift women and uplift our communities. So I think grounding yourself in anti-imperialism is a great way to make sure that, you know, your feminism is, you know, on the best path as possible.
Okay. Noor, it's been a pleasure talking to you and hearing from you. Thanks for being on the show, and have a great International Women's Day.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Noor Jaghama is Code Pink's Palestine and Iran campaigner. We contacted her in Chicago.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland.
The show can air on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download on the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.